Hey everybody, how are you today? My name is Taylor and this is Morbid Academy. First of all, I saw Evanescence and Hailstorm in concert last weekend and oh my god, I can die happy now. I can die happy. We had amazing seats. They were in the mezzanine, so they weren't like super up close, but we had a beeline. We were right in the middle. So every time Amy Lee was singing and looking up right into the middle, she was looking at me and my friend. She couldn't see us, but she was looking at us. I can die happy now. Oh my God, it was amazing. I got chills. I fell in love all the time. And Amy Lee made me cry. No joke, like 5 or 6 times, no exaggeration. Oh my God. At one point, she said how the last 2 years have been the last 2 years and how we all need to feel. We need to stop feeling numb. We need to feel. And then she went on to sing songs about feeling, and I'm just like, these mean so much more than they did before. Amy Lee, why are you doing this to me? So now I listen to Evanescence. I'm like, yep. First of all, I listen to Evanescence and I'm like, I saw you live. Then second, I listen to Evanescence and I cry and everything has more feeling. And I'm like, why? Why'd you do that to me? I know that they canceled the rest of their December shows, unfortunately, because one of the members of their tour group, they didn't say who, because privacy, obviously, contracted COVID, so they're all being safe and canceled the rest of their December shows, but they will be continuing those shows in January. So if you have a chance to go see them, because wow, Hailstorm is amazing. The guitar riffs that they do, the drum solo that the guy did, and just wow. And then there's Evanescence, who's just on a whole nother level. The light show, everything about that show was absolutely amazing. I'm surprised I have a voice because I was screaming my face off. But anyway, back to podcast stuff. This week, I am covering a absolute what the fuck case. Have you heard of the Sodder children or the disappearance of the Sodder children? Have you heard of it? Because, oh my God, nothing makes sense after doing, you know, I've loved this case since I first heard about it on other podcasts and documentaries, but after doing my own research, oh my God, there's a lot more that I didn't think I would know, and then it pulled at my heartstrings, so be prepared for that. This case is absolutely messed up. I do want to take a moment to say that every story that I cover, they are real stories. They happened to real people, and I feel like we need to remember that. Remember the victims, and especially with unsolved cases like this one. I mean, it's technically unsolved. I mean, it is solved, but it's not solved. There's just so much with it. They need to be told so that maybe someday, somewhere, we can get answers. Like with the Golden State Killer, DNA with like one of those ancestry DNA sites caught the Golden State Killer. So I just wanted to say, like, I feel like sometimes we can forget that these are real stories. So I just wanted to say that I feel like that's something we need to remember when listening to true crime or covering true crime. And with this case involves a family that lost 5 children, never got answers, never got peace, and it is crazy, it is heavy, it involves children, so trigger warning. Now, like, you don't hear anything that happens to children, like there is no sexual assault or rape or sexual trauma, physical trauma that actually happens to the kids that you hear about. It is just a family that loses 5 of their children. So, with all of that said, let's get started. So, George Sodder was born Giorgio Sadu, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, like I will in every single episode, and he was born in Sardinia, Italy in 1895, and then immigrated to the U.S. in 1908 when he was about 13 years old. His older brother went with him, but then went back to Italy after George got to Ellis Island. George then found work on the Pennsylvania Railroads, and after a few years, he moved to Smithers, West Virginia, where he then worked as a truck driver and then launched his own trucking company. And then one day he went into a local store and met Jenny Cipriani. Pronunciation is not my strong suit. And she was the owner's daughter. Jenny was born in 1903 and also immigrated to the US in 1906 when she was only 3 years old. The two got married in 1922 and settled just outside of Fayetteville, West Virginia, in a two-story timber frame house. And then in the next 20 years, had 10 children. So they had John in 1923, Joseph in 1924, Marion was born in 1926, George Jr. was born in 1929, Maurice was born in 1931, Martha in 1933, Louis in 1935, Jenny Irene in 1937, Betty in 1940, and finally Sylvia in 1942. Don't worry, you don't need to know the dates of their birth, obviously. You also don't need to know everybody's name, but George's business prospered and the family was said to be, quote, one of the most respected middle-class families around, end quote. And George never talked about his childhood or his time in Italy or why he immigrated and why his family didn't immigrate with him. But he held very strong opinions about pretty much everything from business to current events and politics. And he wasn't shy about expressing these opinions, including his dislike for the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, which led to some pretty strong arguments in the Italian immigrant community that the Sodders lived in. A little heated there, so yay. And by the time Sylvia was born in 1942, the second oldest child, Joe, who was 18 when Sylvia was born, had left to serve in the military during World War II. And then we get to Christmas Eve, 1945. Marion, the oldest daughter, who was 19 at the time, had been working at the dime store downtown and had bought some gifts for the younger kids. Martha, who was 12, Jenny, who was 8, and Betty, who was 5, were so excited for these new gifts, and they asked their mother if they could stay up later past their bedtime. So Jenny said yes, and around 10 p.m., Jenny told them that they could stay up a little longer, as long as Maurice, who was 14, and Louis, who was 9, remembered to put the cows in and feed the chickens before bed. At this point, the older boys, John, who was 22, and George Jr., who was 16, were already asleep, having spent the day working with their dad. Jenny then took 2-year-old Sylvia upstairs to bed with her and went to sleep. Around 12:30 a.m., Jenny was awoken by the telephone ringing. First of all, excuse me, 12:30 and you're calling me? No, go stop it. No. So Jenny goes downstairs to answer it. She didn't recognize the voice, and the person asked for someone that Jenny didn't know, and then she could hear laughter and the clinking of glasses in the background. She said, "You have the wrong number," and later would say that the person had a weird laugh. And then they hung up, and Jenny headed back to bed. On her way to bed, she noticed that the lights were all still on, and the curtains hadn't been closed, which normally the kids would have done if they had gone to bed after their parents. Kind of like their bedtime routine, turn off the lights, close the curtains, lock the door, all that jazz. But none of that happened. And Marion was asleep on the couch, so Jenny just assumed that the others had gone upstairs to the attic to their room to bed and didn't really think much of it. So she turned off the lights, closed the curtains, went to bed. About 30 minutes later, around 1 a.m., Jenny was awoken again by the sound of something hitting the roof with a loud bang and then the sound of it rolling down. She didn't hear anything else, so she just went back to sleep. But then, about 30 minutes later, she was awoken by the smell of smoke. She went into the room that George used as his office, found it on fire near the telephone and fuse box. So she woke up her husband, who then woke up John and George Jr. Jenny grabbed Sylvia, and the six of them made it out of the house. George, Jenny, John, George Jr., Marion, and Sylvia. But the other five kids were still upstairs. The family was yelling for their kids but couldn't hear any response. Jenny said later, quote, "I ran to the bottom of the stairs where the children were supposed to be sleeping. I yelled and yelled, and two boys, John and George Jr., came stumbling down. Their hair was singed by the flames," end quote. George then tried to get back inside but ended up cutting his arm along the way. I found different accounts, like he had to bash open a window to get through. He climbed up the wall in through a window. It doesn't matter. He cut his arm and he wasn't able to get up the stairs because they were completely engulfed in flames. He then thought of getting to the upstairs bedroom through the window outside, but when he got around the corner, the ladder that was usually kept leaning against the house was nowhere to be found at all. So then he thought, okay, I will get one of my trucks and drive it underneath so that I can climb up to get to the window. But none of the cars would start. I think there were two of them. They were his companies. None of them would start, even though they worked perfectly the day before. Yeah, already stuff is just like, what the fuck? And then in a desperate effort, he tried to just scoop water from the rain barrel with his hands, but it was completely frozen solid. The phone, obviously, in the house, in the flames, not gonna work. So Marion ran to the neighbors to call the fire department, but she didn't get any response. Another neighbor saw the flames and tried to call. They didn't get a response either. How do you not get a response? So then another neighbor drove into town, tried calling from a tavern, and then found the fire chief, F.J. Morris, who then initiated, quote, "the Fayetteville version of a fire alarm, a phone tree system where one firefighter called another, who then called another." Now, the fucking fire department was only 2.5 miles away from the Sodders' home. They didn't get to the home until 8 a.m., 7 hours later. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pissed off too. Don't you worry. Of course, 7 hours later, the house was completely destroyed. It was just ash at that time. The fire department was already low on power due to the war, so they had to rely on volunteer firefighters. And for some reason, the fire chief said that he had to wait for somebody to drive the truck because he couldn't. Why? Why couldn't you drive it? Were you drunk? You're the fire chief. You're supposed to know how to drive the freaking truck. How do you not know how to drive the freaking truck? Seriously? It's an emergency. It's 2.5 miles down the road. You can drive it. I'm pretty sure you could drive it 2.5 miles. I don't. So the fire turned the house into ash in like a matter of 45 minutes. And like I said before, the fire truck didn't show up for like 6 to 7 hours. There was a brief search of the grounds, but by 10 a.m., no remains of the five children were found. None at all. Chief Morris suggested that the fire had been hot enough to cremate the bodies, but an official heat index was never taken, so they have no idea how hot the fire actually was. Don't worry, I will talk about that. I will talk about everything. Oh my God, yes, I will. This is a long one, by the way. So the police had followed the fire department to the scene, and one of the investigators who had combed through the rubble said that the fire was due to faulty wiring. Yeah, I hate everybody. 5 days later, despite the fire marshal's request to leave the site untouched for further investigation, George bulldozed about 5 feet of dirt over the remains of the home, and the family planted flowers as a memorial for their children, which that day technically would have been Lewis's, the 9-year-old's, 10th birthday when they did that. And the medical examiner issued 5 death certificates just before New Year's with the cause of death as fire or suffocation, in quotes. Again, there were no bodies, so they had honestly really no clue what happened. And then the funeral was held for the 5 children on January 2nd, 1946. Maurice was 14, Martha was 12, Louis was 9. Again, he just 5 days before his 10th birthday. Jenny Irene was 8, and Betty was 5 at the time of the fire. George and Jenny were unable to make it to the funeral because of how devastated they were, obviously, but the older children did attend. Then the Sodders started looking back on the last few months before the fire and recalling strange incidents and thinking maybe their children actually survived. One, the ladder, which was usually on the side of the house, had been moved and was later found in an embankment about 75 feet away from the house. Two, the odd phone call that Jenny got just before the fire. Three, the fact that they couldn't reach the fire department by any of the neighbors' phones. Four, the trucks didn't work when they had worked perfectly just the day before. Five, 2 months before the fire, an insurance salesman came to the house and tried to sell George life insurance. When George declined, the man got angry and said, quote, "Your house will go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed." He then attributed it all to, quote, "the dirty remarks you have been making about Mussolini," end quote, who had been executed just the year before. Number six, another person had come to the home looking for work from George, and when George said he didn't need any work done or he didn't need any more employees, the man had gone around the back of the house and told George that the fuse boxes would, quote, "cause a fire someday." But George had just had the house rewired when an electric stove was put in, and the electric company said that everything was safe and fine. Number seven, in the weeks before the fire, the older boys said that they had noticed a strange car parked along the main highway, and the occupants of that car watched the younger kids as they would return home from school. Yeah, like I said, everything is just, this whole case is just, what the fuck? We're not even done yet. Number eight, when the medical examiner called for an inquest a few days after the fire so that they could determine the cause of death, because I guess that's a thing you have to do, one of the jurors was the salesman who threatened George. And they said that it was faulty wiring and yeah. Number nine, a telephone repairman had come out and told the Sodders that the phone line hadn't been burned in the fire. It was cut. Somebody had climbed up the 14-foot pole and cut the wire that was like 2 feet out from the pole. And if fire had been due to faulty wiring, like the fire department said, the power would have been out, but everything still worked. According to one article I read, a man was seen stealing items from the Sodder property around the time of the fire. He was identified and arrested and admitted to the theft and that he had been the one to cut the phone line, thinking it was the power line, but denied having anything to do with the fire. Now, there is no record about identifying the man or why he would want to cut any of the electrical wires to the house, or what happened to him afterward. Like, it's literally that one thing, and then there's no arrest report, there's no follow-up, nothing. Then Jenny said in an interview about 20 years later in 1968 that if the power had been cut, no one would have been able to make it out of the house. The reason why they were able to get out is because the lights were still on, so they could see their way to safety. So again, they said it was faulty wiring. Why was the power still on? Number 10. Jenny had gone through the rubble around the house and found that some of the kitchen appliances were still recognizable, along with some of the tin fragments from the roof. So how in the hell did the fire destroy the bones of all her children to the point where no bones were ever found, but not the kitchen appliances? She then found an article in the newspaper about another house fire where a family of seven had been killed, and the skeletal remains of all of those victims were found. Jenny then tried doing her own little experiment, which, smart, honestly, and burned a small pile of animal bones, either, like, I think she did it on a couple occasions using different types of animal bones, and they weren't destroyed at all. Someone who worked at the local crematorium then told Jenny that human bones remain even after bodies are burned at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours. When I looked it up, it said that the crematorium chamber gets up to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, but it can take between 3 to 4 hours for the body to turn to ash. And at ground zero, after the 9/11 attacks, remains were found that survived the jet fuel fires. So where the fuck are the bones? If those children died in that fire, where are their bones? That fire lasted for like 45 minutes. It lasted 45 minutes. So how in the freaking hell are there absolutely no bones to be found? There's nothing, nothing. And 11, a local bus driver said that he saw people throwing, quote, balls of fire at the house late on Christmas Eve. In the spring, when the Sodders went back to the rubble after the snow had melted, Sylvia, the 2-year-old, found a small dark green rubber ball-like object in the brush. George said that it looked like a pineapple bomb hand grenade or some other kind of incendiary device, which would explain what Jenny heard that night, when she was woken up from something hitting the roof and then rolling off. The family also later said that they believed the fire started on the roof, but obviously there was no way to prove it at that point. And then the sightings of the Sodder children started popping up. A girl claimed to see the children in a car that was driving away from the fire. An employee of a motel about 50 miles away claimed to have seen the children the day after the fire. A woman who worked at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston said that she had served them breakfast the next morning and noted a car with Florida license plates in the parking lot. 2 years after the fire in 1947, George found a newspaper photo of school children in New York and was convinced that one of the children was Betty, who was the 5-year-old who went missing. So George jumped into the car and drove to New York, but he was not able to see the child. Which, I mean, if I were the parents of the child, I wouldn't want some random guy coming up to my house and being like, I need to see that kid, I think it's my child. No. Be like, no. But then if it was, I'd be like, I don't know. I wouldn't, yeah. I don't know what I would do, but I mean, I can see it from their point. So, nothing in this story is adding up, right? Absolutely nothing. Is it adding up to you? Is it? Seriously, is it? Answer me. I need answers. So, George and Jenny didn't think so either. They were convinced that their children were still out there and kidnapped somehow, survived the fire, and so they hired a private investigator, C.C. Tinsley. Tinsley was able to find out that apparently Fire Chief Morris, you know, the guy who wasn't able to drive the frickin' truck, had found a heart in the ashes but never told the Sodders and buried it at the scene in a metal box. He apparently confessed this to a local minister who then confirmed it to George. Tinsley then confronted Morris about it, and Morris took both him and George to where he buried the box. They then took the box to a local funeral director who examined it and found that it was just a piece of beef liver that had never even been exposed to fire. Supposedly, Morris had placed the box with just a random piece of beef liver at the site in hopes that the Sodders would find it and it would give them some peace in that their children did die in the fire and weren't kidnapped. Which, I mean, yeah, I can see why he would want to do that, but also, no, you don't do that. He also never told them. But anyway, at one point, George even wrote to the FBI hoping that he could get them interested in the possible kidnapping of his children. And the director, J. Edgar Hoover, even personally responded to his letters and said, quote, "Although I would like to be of service, the matter related appears to be of local character and does not come within the investigative jurisdiction of this bureau," end quote. The Fayetteville police and fire departments could have asked the FBI's assistance, but they declined to do so. Thanks, police. Then, in August 1949, almost 4 years after the fire, George got Oscar Hunter, who was a Washington, D.C. pathologist, to supervise a new search at the site of the fire, where they found a dictionary that belonged to the children and some coins. Again, if those things survived, how did the bones not? But then they did find small bone fragments that were determined to be vertebrae. They sent the vertebrae to a specialist at the Smithsonian who confirmed that they were vertebrae, all from the same person. Quote, "Since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years. The top limit of age should be about 22, since the centra, which normally fuse at 23, are still unfused," end quote. Basically, all you need to know about that is that parts of the vertebrae were fused, meaning that the child that they belonged to or the body that they belonged to had to be 16 or 17 up to 22 years old. But that means the bones weren't from the missing children because the oldest, Maurice, was 14 at the time. The report did say that the vertebrae of a boy his age could sometimes be advanced enough to appear to be at the lower end of the age range, so 16 or 17. But the specialist then said that the bones showed no signs of being exposed to fire. So all in all, fucked up, weird, what the hell. And they were the only bones found. So again, no bones of the five missing children were ever found at the site. Even the specialist said that full skeletons should have been left after the short amount of time that the fire was burning. The report went on to say that the bones probably were dug up from when George bulldozed the dirt over the remains of the house, which brings on just another crazy thing to this crazy case. Tinsley supposedly confirmed that these bones were from a cemetery that was nearby, but couldn't explain why they had been taken from the cemetery and how they got to the Sodders' property. So again, just another fucked up crazy thing being like, how the hell did how? At this point, the investigation and findings gained national attention, obviously. And the West Virginia legislature held two hearings on the case in 1950. The governor and the state police superintendent then told the Sodders that the case was, quote, hopeless, and closed the case at the state level. So technically, it is a closed case, but this didn't deter the Sodders one bit. In 1952, George and Jenny bought a billboard along Route 16 and passed out flyers with a reward of $5,000 for information, along with the pictures of the five missing children. Today, that $5,000 would be $52,443. But then soon after, they upped the reward to $10,000, which today is $104,886. Holy crap. And then, of course, more tips started coming in. A woman at a Charleston hotel said that she saw the children checking in with two women and two men, all of Italian extraction. Whatever Italian extraction means. I tried to talk to the children in a friendly manner, but the men appeared hostile and refused to allow me to talk to these children. One of the men looked at me in a hostile manner. He turned around and began talking rapidly in Italian. Immediately, the whole party stopped talking to me. I sensed I was being frozen out, and so I said nothing more. They left early the next morning. End quote. A letter from a woman in St. Louis, Missouri, said that Martha was in a convent there, and a patron at a bar in Texas claimed to have heard two people making incriminating statements about a fire on Christmas Eve in West Virginia. And a claim came from Florida saying that the kids were with a distant relative of Jenny's. George followed up on all of these tips, traveling to those areas, but nothing ever came of it. And then other rumors of the kids being sold to orphanages, being taken to Italy, all surfaced, and many suggested that maybe the mafia had been involved. I'll get to that in a little bit. In 1968, almost 23 years after the fire, the most credible piece of evidence came to the Sodders in a letter with a photo of a young man who resembled Louis Sodder, who was just 5 days shy of his 10th birthday. The letter was postmarked Kentucky, but didn't have a return address. And on the back of the photo was a handwritten message that said, "Louis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, ILIL boys, A90132 or 35. So again, just what the fuck? And don't worry, I will post the picture of Louis at the time of the fire, and then this picture that Jenny and George believed was Louis. They could not deny the resemblance of Louis and the young man in the picture. So again, the Sodders hired another private investigator and sent them to Kentucky, but they never heard from him again. He took the money, went to Kentucky, and that was it. They then updated the billboard with a new picture of Louis and hung an enlarged version over the fireplace. And in an interview that George did, he said, quote, "Time is running out for us, but we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them." End quote. It just breaks my heart. George then passed away a year later in 1969 at the age of 73. Jenny and her surviving children continued to look for answers, and it was said that Jenny stayed in the family home after her husband's death, put a fence up around the property, and kept adding rooms to the home. I don't know where the home was, if they did not rebuild on the site of the fire. I don't know where their new home was, but she did. It said that she also wore only black in mourning, and then she continued to tend to the garden at the site of the fire for the rest of her life until she passed away in 1989 at the age of 85. John, Joe, George Jr., Marion, and Sylvia all married and had children of their own, but continued to try to find answers about their siblings. They did take down the billboard when their mother passed away after being up for almost 40 years. Biggest theory, going back a little bit, that the family and friends believed was that the Sicilian mafia was involved. This is all a theory. Just remember that. It's a theory. I don't know what happened. It's a theory. Many believed that because of George's anti-fascist views and dislike for Mussolini, that he was very upfront about, may have caused some discourse in the Italian community in which they lived. George never talked about his childhood in Italy or why he left, especially on his own. So people were like, what happened over there, George? They theorized that the mafia was extorting money, but no ransom was ever made that we know of. Maybe somebody knew about the planned fire and took the children for safety. Maybe they were taken back to Italy. Maybe if the children survived the fire and knew their parents and other siblings survived too, maybe they weren't making contact in order to protect them, as in their family. And with the fire department not being able to contact the fire department, did the mafia say, yo, you're not allowed to attend to this fire. Attend to the fire. You're not allowed to firefight. You're not allowed to firefight. That's what I'm looking for. I mean, it took them 7 hours to respond and 2.5 hours away. So did the mafia have something to do with that? Again, this is all theorized. It's all theorized. Don't come at me. And then we still have the things that still do not make any sense whatsoever. Not that anything about this case makes any sense. One, the wrong number call in the middle of the night before the fire. Was it actually a wrong number, or was somebody calling to make sure that at least someone was awake to survive the fire? Two, the coincidence that the missing children were the same ones who stayed up late and are all the five youngest, not including Sylvia, who was taken to bed with her mother. Three, who moved the ladder and hid it in the embankment 75 feet away from the home? Four, who messed with the cars, or did George or his sons accidentally flood the engine in their panic to get the kids from the attic? Five, the fact that no one could get a hold of the fire department. Six, where did the private investigator who was sent to Kentucky go? Seven, was that really Lewis in the picture, and what the fuck did the message mean? Eight, if the kids were kidnapped, how? Marion was asleep on the couch in the living room. Did all the kids go outside with Maurice and Lewis, who were told to take in the cows and feed the chickens, and then they were taken from outside? Did they go out after Marion was asleep? Did they even go back to the attic? And if they weren't in the attic at all, like before the fire, why bother moving the ladder and messing with the cars? And then that's the other thing. If they did go upstairs to the attic, how did the person get them from the attic without making any noise? It is just absolutely so messed up. Nothing makes sense. Literally nothing makes sense about this case. It's just fucked up. John, who was 22 at the time of the fire, passed away in 2001 at the age of 78. Marion, who was 19 at the time of the fire, passed away in 2005 at the age of 79. Joe, who was 21 at the time of the fire and in the military, so away from the home, passed away in 2010 at the age of 85. George Jr. was 16 and passed away in 2012 at the age of 83. Sylvia, who was 2 at the time of the fire, said in an interview in 2013 that the fire was her earliest memory. She said that she and her father would stay up late and talk about what might have happened. Quote, I experienced their grief for a long time, end quote. She continued to believe that her siblings survived that night and assisted with efforts to find them. Other reports said that she went on like those crime sleuthing web sleuth sites to try and find answers. In 2006, her daughter said, quote, she promised my grandparents she wouldn't let the story die, that she would do everything she could, end quote. And every year, Sylvia organized a memorial meeting in Fayetteville, and every Christmas, the town goes over what happened that night and repeats their reasons for believing their version of the story. Sylvia passed away and I'm getting teary-eyed. This one just hits differently. Sylvia passed away in April 2021, so just a few months ago, at the age of 79. I'm not sure if her children and grandchildren continue to search for answers, but I would like to believe that they are. I think they are. I don't know. I'm getting choked up about this one, guys. I'm sorry. Today, Maurice would be 90 years old. Martha would be 88. Lewis would be 86. Jenny Irene would be 84. And Betty would be 81. So there is a possibility that they could still be out there somewhere. if they survived that fire, which I full-heartedly believe that they did not die in that fire. So it is possible that they could still be out there. And now, to just bring it on home with sadness, I found this quote from an article from NPR in 2005. For some, the children died 60, now 76, years ago. For the family and many of their neighbors who grew up looking into the faces of the Sodder children and who firmly believe the children are still out there, this could be the Christmas they finally come home. End quote. Cue the tears. I'm sorry. I know. Ugh. I saw that quote and I had to use it because it just, they could still be out there. This one just hits home. I don't know why. I told you this was a fucked up story, and damn did it just hit differently after doing my own research. I have listened to this case from at least 2, maybe 3 podcasts, and after doing my own research, it just hits differently. Personally, I believe that they did not die in that fire and could possibly still be out there. There is just too much to say that they died in that fire with no bodies to show for it. That it's just, there's just way too much. What if that picture really is Lewis? Or was Lewis, because he'd be older. But, and what the fuck did that cryptic message mean? Hell, they caught the Golden State Killer after how many years because of DNA from like his cousin or something? I don't remember who it was. They could do that now. Everybody who is related to the surviving Sodders. So all of the Sodder grandchildren need to get their DNA tested to find the others. That's what needs to happen. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's thought about this. I'm sure they have thought about this. I just want answers. I want the family to get answers. I mean, the whole Sodder family that went through this is gone. They all have all passed away. So I just want them to get answers. I'm sorry. I want them to have peace. But I also believe that if the missing children have passed on, that then they are all in heaven and at peace now and have their answers up in heaven. Now, if they could just send down those answers from heaven, that would be great because I need some answers. Oh my God, my heart with this case. I am sorry. This case just gets to me. I don't know why. I think it's because how hard they looked for them for the rest of their lives. They looked for them. There are no answers. I think that's why. I don't know. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, get it together, Taylor. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Let me know your thoughts over on Instagram, on Facebook, on YouTube, Coffee, Creeps, and Cake. I would love to talk about this with somebody. This is one of those cases that I'm just like, yo, let's go. I need to talk about this with somebody. Thank you so much for listening. Please tell me I'm not the only one who cried. Please tell me I'm not the only one who cried. I didn't think I was going to cry because as I was writing it, I cried and I was like, okay, well, I already got the tears out and now I'm talking about it and ugh, the tears again. So again, thank you so much for listening. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you rate and review your podcasts. Really helps me out. Really helps the podcast out. Also, share it with everybody. I noticed that all of a sudden my downloads like stopped basically after episode 15. I know there was some glitches with platforms. I did get that all settled up. So please share it. Get everyone to listen. Greatly appreciate it. I love you all. Rate, review, do all that. And as always, you can find Morbid Academy wherever you get your podcasts with new episodes out every Friday and the videos out on YouTube on Saturdays at Coffee, Creeps, and Cake. If you would like to get the episodes early, I usually put them out on Thursdays, sometimes Wednesdays, as well as exclusive content, first looks, and more. You can do that by heading over to patreon.com/morbidacademy and donating. Thanks so much. You also get a discount off merch. If you would like to just donate an amount of your choosing without becoming a member, without doing a whole monthly subscription type thing, you can do that by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/morbidacademy. You can check out the merch at morbidacademymerch.com. please, if you get a shirt, tag me on Instagram or Facebook. I would love to see you repping the podcast. It means a lot to me. You can follow along on Instagram and Facebook at Morbid Academy. If you have a story you would like me to cover in future episodes, or if you have a story of your own, I want to read it, and then I want other people to listen to me reading it. I want it. Those episodes on other podcasts are amazing, and I know y'all have some crazy stories. So please, please, I want to hear them. Even if you make it up, I want to hear it. But anyway, you can email me all of that. Or if you just want to talk, you can email me at morbidacademy@gmail.com. I have no life, so seriously, come chat with me. You and me. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening. I'm sorry if I made you cry. And I hope you keep it creepy, friends. Bye-bye.